Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to Legal Face Off. This is our first show of 2019 as we enter our sixth year, maybe fifth year, something like that.
Happy New Year, Richie.
Happy New Year, Tina. Happy New Year, Ben, our trusty and hardworking, dedicated producer. We've got a jam-packed show today, Tina. It's unbelievable how much legal news is going on in the early part of the new year. We've got Gary Chico, who's running for mayor of Chicago, leading us off. Then we will be covering the Major Goldstein murder charge, which we talked about on our last show, but we're going to take a deeper dive with an expert on that. And then we've got Amanda Vinicky, who always comes in around this time of year to update us on the new laws in the state of Illinois. And of course, we'll be covering the breaking legal news with some very special guests, including Harry Tynowitz and a colleague of yours, Tina. In our grab bag, we'll be covering some news involving aldermen in Chicago, some intellectual property, some other interesting stories. But kicking this off again is Gary Chico, who is running for mayor of Chicago.
Good to be with you both. Good to be with you and your audience.
So, Gary, there's clearly a lot going on in the city of Chicago, as well as in the state of Illinois. We're in the middle of hearing what's going on with Alderman Burke right now. What is it about this political climate? There's obviously been a lot going on in Chicago, as well as Illinois, that has caused this mayoral race to shape up the way that it has.
Well, I think there's a rare opportunity to have new leadership in Chicago. When that happens, and it's an open seat like it is now, there's an awful lot of people that express interest in it. I happen to think I have the broadest and deepest experience of the candidates, having served as chief of staff for the mayor, having been president of the school board, having been president of the park district and chairman of the city colleges. All of those things help make up the city for what it is. And so I think that I offer my candidacy with the broadest and deepest experience to be able to serve the people of this city.
Gary, what are your thoughts on the Burke situation? Obviously, we're covering it later in our show. I just came off John Williams' show was on Cochran this morning talking about it. You've come out with some thoughts on it, as well as the allegation that Tony Preckwinkle, who is one of your chief rivals for the mayoral spot, received a campaign donation as part of this whole alleged shakedown. What are your thoughts on the whole thing?
Well, I think she got the campaign donation. They didn't report it right away. And they have some explaining to do about that. And I'll let them handle their own explaining. But I think the situation with Alderman Burke is disturbing. I mean, I obviously don't like to hear those allegations. And, you know, he'll obviously have his day in court. I think he did the right thing by stepping down from the chairmanship of the Finance Committee, because we have to remember the most important interests here are those of the people. So the city government has to continue to function without distraction and without delay. And I'm glad that the alderman stepped down to let the city business continue unhampered.
So there's a lot of ground to cover here, Gary, and I know that you've mentioned your thoughts on various issues involving the city. Why don't we take a look at least a couple of those issues? First of all, public safety and the need for the police to restore trust with the community. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's paramount. If we don't have the community believing in the police department and trusting them, and likewise, we don't have the police officers having faith in the community, well, this has it amounts to a breakdown. So I've called for a change in leadership in the police department by letting Eddie Johnson go. It's not personal. I just think that we need to have somebody who's in charge of this department who's going to inspire confidence and faith, and who's going to bring back community policing to the level that we need in this city so that we can actually actively work as community and police together to get out in front of crime and solve crime. So I think that that's critical. Also, we've called for abiding by the consent decree that's being approved by the federal court right now. And we've also proposed attacking gun violence in a very serious way by appointing a deputy superintendent of the police department whose sole responsibility will be to get at gun violence. And if that requires us to bring actions against Indiana and Wisconsin for the flow of guns over their borders into our city, then we'll take that action, because we, like they, have to protect our citizenry. So we've proposed a number of things that we think will make the city safer, not the least of which, in addition to those things, is looking at this whole problem of crime in a different way. We have to realize that there's a pipeline right now of people coming into criminal activity that just keep feeding the problem. Why? Because we're not doing anything to really invest in people to keep them out of the criminal cycle to begin with. There's programs like those of the Heartland Alliance called the Ready Initiative, which actually look to recruit people out of gangs and keep some of them from ever going into the gang in the first place by offering them intensive job training and therapy to keep them working in the positive world of work and helping them cope with some of the issues that led them into a criminal life to begin with. That kind of investment we're going to make. We call for a $50 million commitment to the Ready Initiative so that we can drive a wedge right into this criminality cycle in neighborhoods that's gripping these neighborhoods and try to make things better for people and safer for people.
Gary, you just launched two ads yesterday that talk about your background and why you feel you should be the next mayor of Chicago. Part of the campaign or part of the ads talk about your service as head of Chicago Public Schools in the 90s and also your leadership of City Colleges of Chicago. Talk to us about your plans for educational reform should you be elected mayor.
Well, clearly people are demanding more of our public schools. They want it, whether it's more preschool. They want it, whether it's more high school, different high school options. I was just talking with a parent a little while ago who lives in Ravenswood, who was talking about the real anxiety that's caused by parents who are about to have their children enter high school, and they just can't get into these selective enrollment and special programs. So I think we need to look at increasing the capacity there so that parents aren't pulling their hair out when the ordinary transition of going to high school takes place. We don't want them to leave our system. We don't, God forbid, we don't want them to leave our city. So, I mean, we're going to make that kind of program available to parents throughout the city. We're also going to make sure that our special programs, International Baccalaureate, STEM, and programs like that, are going to be available on a broad basis throughout the city in every part of the city. Right now, our offerings are way too spotty, and people are not happy with what we're doing. And this is why we're losing population, not only in the city, but in the public school system. We need to do better, we can do better, and we will do better.
So, Gary, last question on Legal Face-Off. We've actually been asking other mayoral candidates that we've had on the show the same question. What do you think Rahm Emanuel's legacy will be as mayor?
I think Rahm Emanuel's done a very good job in tackling some very, very difficult issues that have been persistent problems for years. I mean, his attempt to try to shore up the city finances by all kinds of means is admirable. His work on bringing companies to this city, all over the city, and even downtown. Remember, we can't have downtown pitted against the neighborhoods, really, because we have to all be one city. And remember, a lot of people live in our neighborhoods, work downtown. But we do need to pay more attention to building up our neighborhood infrastructure downtown, in the neighborhoods, along our commercial thoroughfares, in our parks, our schools. All of that can be better. But I think Rahm will go down as someone who worked very hard for the city, believed in the things that he worked on, and he was an absolute tireless worker on behalf of the issues in this city.
He's been named Chicagoan of the Year by Chicago Magazine. He's been named Citizen of the Year by the City Club of Chicago. That's Gary Chico. He's running for mayor of Chicago. The election's February 26th. The website to find out more about Gary's campaign is chicoformayor.com. Gary, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off. And before we let you go, what's your prediction for Sunday?
Oh, Bears all the way. Are you kidding me? The question is going to be what? How many points do they beat them by? The Bears are going to win, and they're going to go all the way.
I think you
we
just
need it in this city.
I think you just won. I think you just won a lot of votes.
Well, let me tell you something. I am such a huge fan of Vic Fangio and what Matt Nagy's done for this team. They've really, really brought a sense of pride to the Monsters of the Midway.
Well, I think Fangio's going to pull a Buddy Ryan and win the Super Bowl, then go coach somewhere else. We'll see what happens.
Let's at least win the Super Bowl. I'm fully behind these guys. I've been a Bears fan my whole life.
Well, we'll see you on Sunday, Gary. Thanks for joining us, and good luck on the campaign trail.
Good to be with you, Rich and Christina. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Tina, our second guest today on Legal Faceoff is now an annual tradition. I think this might be the third or fourth year. Amanda Vinicky has come on to update us on the newest laws in Illinois for 2019. Amanda Vinicky, of course, is a correspondent and segment host on Chicago Tonight here in Chicago, and she's been the go-to person on all things Springfield for over a decade. So we're very privileged to have Amanda Vinicky on Legal Faceoff. Welcome.
Well, you're so nice. What a way to start 2019. Thank you.
Well, we've got some great new laws, some really interesting stuff. Some very serious, of course, and there's always a couple of, you know, more strange ones that we want to cover. But the first one is dealing with both gun purchases and gun owners. There's a couple of separate ones. Update us on those if you can.
Yeah, these are definitely fall into the more significant or serious category. I always do like to point out, by the way, that while we'll be highlighting a few, it is impossible really to get to all of the new laws because whether or not your listeners knew it, once the, you know, clock struck midnight in the new year, some 250 new laws actually went into effect. And, I don't think, like, you know, I mean, if a law changes, it's you guys are the attorneys, but it's not an excuse to say I didn't know about it. So tune into Legal Faceoff to be aware of what is going
on. That's right, exactly. Yeah,
these are two of the more significant ones, those relating to firearms. And I'm sure not the last of firearms legislation that we will hear, particularly as a new administration and Democratic supermajorities take over in Springfield. That will be one of the many issues on the incoming Governor J.B. Pritzker's list of to-dos there. But one of them has to do with a waiting period for guns. And this is an interesting one politically in the sense that actually Governor Bruce Rauner himself, an avid hunter and somebody who says that he is an advocate of firearms rights and actually continued to have the support of the Illinois State Rifle Association, despite having actually proposed this, he proposed it as sort of a greater change in law after nixing a plan that would require state licensing of firearms dealers. And this is a law that expands the 72-hour waiting period for all gun purchases made in the state. Previously, there was this sort of 3-day window between when you bought a handgun and when you could actually bring it home, but it only applied to handguns. And a lot of people sort of maybe found that strange because the guns that are often perceived to be more dangerous, so-called assault weapons, think an AR-15 or so, did not have to undergo that longer waiting period. It was just a one-day turnaround. And so now, again, all gun sales in Illinois will have to go for that 72-hour waiting period before any individual can actually bring them home. And that's supposed to leave, you know, time for any sort of checks that need to be done.
Can you tell us about the new law about flagging dangerous gun owners?
Yeah, of course. So that is the so-called red flag law. What it does is lets somebody, say you have a loved one and you're recognizing some signs, something that seems amiss, and that could be anything from, you know, mental health issues that may strike a fear of, you know, suicide or depression, or something that could be even, you know, larger, you're thinking sort of a mass shooting situation, even domestic violence. This would say that anybody who recognizes that in a relative who does currently have the legal right to a gun could go to a judge, petition the court for a sort of lethal order of protection, is what it is actually termed, that would strip that gun owner of their fire owner's identification card so that they could no longer legally have or buy a gun in the state of Illinois. And that would be for a temporary period. It could be for up to 2 weeks, or that could, through legal proceedings, be carried out for a longer period. And that comes, of course, after we saw a variety of situations. Think back to, you know, the Waffle House shooting, which had an Illinois connection, for example, where it was like, how does this person have a gun when there had been all of these warning signs? This is supposed to do that. And by the way, while the focus that I just made there was on relatives, police or law enforcement could also petition a court to have this sort of waiting period. Again, this is a law that really got carefully negotiated in Springfield because firearm rights activists said, hey, this seems like, you know, a legal path toward taking away my gun. If, you know, an enemy or somebody wanted to take it away from me, this was carefully negotiated. So while certainly not everybody agrees with it, and there are those who believe that this is infringing on the Second Amendment rights of certain gun owners, by and large, this did pass and was, you know, signed into law with the recognition that it will hopefully be a mechanism to prevent, again, domestic violence situations, suicides, any sort of mass shootings, what have you, by providing a way to do something, kind of a, if you see something, say something, and do something to take precautions.
Amanda, another law requires all Illinois schools to conduct at least one law enforcement-led active shooter safety drill each year. Of course, again, in the wake of all of the school shootings that we've unfortunately seen, there's another one that's received a lot of attention, which mandates that all children under the age of 2 must be secured in a rear-facing child restraint system. That is HB 4377. Before the law was a little bit looser with regards to restraining your children in the car.
You know, so the active shooter safety drills, yes, that has to be conducted within the first few months, of school taking in session, and it is a sad sign of the times, really. And then in terms of this the rear-facing safety seat, you know, that's one that, to me, I have to admit, like, I do not have a child, and I have vague memories of, you know, sitting in a booster chair, like, the car seat in my parents' car. But this, it's something that updates state law, and now kids, I believe they have to be in a car seat until really 8 years old. But now this further stipulates that children under the age of 2 have to be in a rear-facing restraint system, and that's for the protection of the kids. It's supposed to, you know, be better for them. If they're facing backwards, then they're less likely to suffer from a head injury. I know that I heard from actually a former colleague who used to be a reporter in Illinois and is now in Washington, D.C., saw that law and said, my 2-year-old no way could fit in a rear-facing child restraint system. No way, no how. There is an exemption for kids who are on the bigger side, so a child who may be under the age of 2 but weighs more than 40 pounds or is taller than 40 inches is exempt from that.
So, Amanda, there's a lot more that we would love to cover, but unfortunately, we're down to the wire here. The last one I'd like to ask you about, I didn't even know was really an issue. Hunters can now wear pink. Can you tell us?
Thank God this has been fixed.
Yeah, I was just going to say, now I can breathe easier in 2019. You want to tell us about it?
Before, when I was shooting deer, Tina, I always wanted to wear pink, and now I finally can, Amanda. Thank God.
I went to a Becoming an Outdoors Woman workshop, which was previously organized through the Department of Natural Resources. And I got to tell you, there are a lot of outdoorsy women who wear pink, but then I'd heard that Wisconsin has a similar law, and they actually have not seen any sort of surge in blaze pink sales. So it's not just any pink. It has to be a certain, that like really bright fluorescent pink. And really, it's for the protection of hunters. And so this is during deer season. If you're out and about, you want to be visible, not blend in too much so that you, you know, don't get accidentally shot or injured while you're trying to blend in. So now blaze pink is something that is permitted in addition to blaze orange. And I actually heard Governor Bruce Rauner talking about this, and Rauner had sort of an interesting take. He said that actually the pink is preferable. So I don't know if he went and bought himself some new pink duds, because he said that the orange, even though it's fluorescent, could blend in with natural surroundings during deer season. So he seemed to give an extra two thumbs up to the pink color.
Well, Illinois hunters happy with that. Our deer listeners, not so much. All the deers listening to our show, not so much. That's Amanda Vinicky, at Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent and, of course, segment host on Chicago Tonight on WTTW. Amanda, thank you so much for coming on Legal Face Off again.
Thanks. Happy New Year, and happy following all those new laws.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, that's compalliance.com.
Tina, our last story before we get into the grab bag today is a follow-up to something we covered, I think, on our last show, dealing with very interesting story about military law, the story of Matt Goldstein, a Special Forces veteran who now faces a murder charge. Interesting for that, and also because the president weighed in, as he often does.
Yes.
We're going to talk about all of that with an expert in this field, Professor Rachel Van Lanningham. She's a professor of law at Southwestern Law School. She's also a former judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force. We're very privileged to have her on Legal Face Off. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Rachel, just give our listeners a quick summary, if you can, of the story involving Matt Goldstein.
Thank you. First of all, I don't have any personal knowledge. I just have what I've read the news as well, and that is that the president suddenly took to Twitter a few weeks ago after seeing a Fox News report detailing the Army's preferral of charges, that is an initial preliminary investigation under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's a preferral of charges against an Army Green Beret for alleged murder.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And so, and the Army has a legal duty as well as a moral obligation to investigate all credible allegations of war crimes. And apparently Major Goldstein had said during a polygraphed interview with the CIA, an employment interview, that he had taken a suspected Taliban bomb maker into custody, and that instead of releasing him as he was ordered to do, he shot and killed him. He admitted to burying the body, which is highly unusual, and then soliciting two other soldiers to go back and burn the body. So, of course, the CIA passed that information on to the Army, and the Army subsequently investigated. But there's been a long investigation. Apparently, the Army was unable to corroborate any of the major's polygraphed statements to the CIA. And within military justice, as well as within most criminal law, there's this corpus delicti rule, basically show me the body. There has to be more in order to prosecute someone than just a bare naked confession. In the military, our courts have required there has to be independent evidence that supports the trustworthiness of the statements. But the Army did go ahead and take administrative action, which requires a lesser standard of proof than a prosecution, and they stripped the major of his Silver Star, and they processed him for discharge. But then they went back last year now, in late 2018, and took the first step to prefer charges in a criminal prosecution. So the major hadn't been fully discharged when they actually preferred charges. And the president weighed in on in a tweet saying that he was going to look into the matter. And he stated it in, of course, a very public way and in a rather inflammatory way. And that raises concerns.
You call him a war hero, in fact.
He did call him a war hero, and in fact, Major Goldstein very well sounds like he is a war hero. He was awarded the Silver Star, but that was subsequently then stripped because of evidence of later misconduct. But one can be a war hero and a war criminal, and the military, including the president as the commander-in-chief, has a legal duty as well as a moral duty to its troops to investigate allegations of war crimes. Perhaps Major Goldstein is completely innocent and that he was following the laws of war and the reigning rules of engagement. But that's what an investigation is required to do. And currently, the Army is in the investigation stage. This has not been in the military. There is a two-stage process for prosecution. First is preferral. Second is referral. This is purely at the preferral stage. It triggers a preliminary hearing in which Major Goldstein will be allowed to present evidence. He can provide anything he wants to the commander who is charged with disposing of this case, with making the decision whether to prosecute or not. And under the laws of war, that the international laws of war and U.S. domestic law, the military is required to investigate and, if appropriate, prosecute war crimes allegations if there's probable cause to do so.
So, Rachel, Major Goldstein said that he couldn't have lived with himself if he had continued to detain this suspect, only to find him potentially shooting at his unit while in custody. We covered this, as Rich mentioned, in one of our last episodes of Legal Face-Off, sort of the dichotomy of killing somebody in what some would call cold-blooded murder for purposes of protecting a unit. On the other hand, can you justify something like this in any circumstance? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it really demonstrates and brings clear the ultimate trust and the veneration that we place in our soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, et cetera, because they are charged with following orders and are given the awful responsibility of killing individuals, but they're given responsibility to kill individuals on behalf of our country according to certain rules. And neither a major nor a general can decide on their own whom to kill and whom they can't. There are rules to follow regarding who to kill. And if the major felt like he absolutely had to do this, that's fine. Then he needs to bring that forward, and that will be evidence at his court-martial, if he is court-martialed. But he doesn't get to make the decision to override rules saying he can't kill someone in his own custody, right? There are processes, there are numerous reasonable alternatives. If he did, in fact, kill someone in U.S. custody, in his very own custody, there are numerous other alternatives to killing him to keep his fellow units, his fellow colleagues safe. That is, going back up the chain of command to demonstrate and emphasize that there was evidence that this wasn't truly, in fact, someone that posed an imminent threat to military forces.
And Professor, go ahead. But I mean, the whole point that you have these rules is to protect ourselves, really, right? I mean, these rules against harming or killing a prisoner in custody goes back not just years, but centuries. It's a basic principle of warfare, and it really is meant to protect ourselves, right? I mean, for every one of the people that were murdered in this case, you know, who knows if other countries will do that to Americans when they're held in custody. The whole reason you sign off on things like the Geneva Convention is to protect Americans in custody.
Not necessarily. Reciprocity isn't the guiding principle behind the laws of war, because if it was, they'd all be thrown out, right? Our enemies today don't follow the laws of war. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda, ISIS, will kill our soldiers and will torture them, and we know that, right? We do this for ourselves. We do it for pragmatic reasons, and we do it for practical reasons, for operational control of the battlefield, and so that we can guarantee to our soldiers that when we're asking them to kill, they can go home with our moral compass intact, that they're killing lawfully and therefore morally. They can come back and look themselves in the mirror and look at their children in the eyes and know that they're not cold-blooded murderers, but in fact that they were soldiers doing their patriotic duty. So it's much more than just reciprocity. It's far more important, which is why the Army takes, and the entire military takes, great pains in order to investigate allegations of war crimes. It owes its current service members that duty to ensure that its service members aren't going rogue, aren't going renegade, and therefore causing this massive chaos on the battlefield, which is why the laws of war developed in the first place, to protect against unnecessary suffering, yes, but also to pragmatically win the war. We can't have soldiers making decisions on their own whom to kill and who can't necessarily, right? They do so under certain guidance, and we do invest quite a bit of trust with them, but it's trust that they will follow the rules that are laid out. And he will have that opportunity to present his side of the story, right? And that's what due process is all about. And he is owed very much so the full due process. And so are the rest of the military members. And President Trump's tweet is dangerous because President Trump, interestingly, has a twofold role here. He is the commander-in-chief of the military. So he is the ultimate convening authority, that is the ultimate prosecutor of any military member. So he could take this case as in his role as commander-in-chief and bring it up to him and decide the disposition. And that's fully within his purview to know what's going on within the military justice system. But to tweet in such an inflammatory manner sends a signal down to the chain of command that, oh, I don't really want you to prosecute this guy because this is going to rile up my base. That is considered unlawful command influence, and that's prohibited by statute. And itself is a failure by the president, both a legal and a moral one.
You think the president knows any of that? I don't think.
If he listens to his advisors, but he doesn't seem to have a history of doing that. But what he's doing is a disservice to everyone else that is serving honorably in the military, which is the vast, vast majority of all service members. Let the due process lead where it may. If he wants to exercise his clemency powers and issue a pardon after the fact because of extenuating circumstances that come out during a court-martial, if there is one, go ahead. That's his right. But don't disrupt the system that requires investigations for the operational efficiency and effectiveness of our military.
Rachel Van Lanningham writes an opinion column for USA Today. Very interesting stuff. Professor Van Lanningham, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off, and please come back on the show.
Thanks for covering such a topical issue. Take care now.
Thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
So, Tina, we mentioned at the top of the show that there is so much legal news. We can't even fit it in one show, but we're going to try. We've got lots of good topics and a couple of really special guests. We've got Harry Tynowitz, who is a Chicago radio legend. I mean, we're just going to say that and let that.
Now people are going to want to take you to court.
For a second. Hosts here on WJAN, of course, and just all around bon vivant, man about town, knows a little bit about everything. So thank you for joining us, Harry. And of course, Pedro De Jesus, who I'd like to have Tina introduce Mr. De Jesus to us.
So Pedro's a good friend. We met 20 years ago when we were both working together at Piper Rudnick, now DLA Piper, and you have been the general counsel of Tampico Beverages since 2007.
Yes.
And we've been working in that capacity as well, and we've done political things together and just generally hung out.
And not a radio legend.
But the day is early.
Yes, sir.
One of the corporate secretary was a legend. All right, let's jump right into the big story of the day, which is Ed Burke, of course, local alderman, 50-year alderman here in the city of Chicago, arrested yesterday. Criminal complaint by the federal government filed against him for attempted extortion. We won't go into all the details because time doesn't permit it, but big deal, right? When the feds come knocking and arrest you and accuse you of on wiretaps, basically shaking down
a Burger King franchisee.
By the way, do you know why this Burger King is famous?
Well, yes, because of the Laquan McDonald murder.
I mean, are there not more than one Burger King's in Chicago? But yeah, this was involved in the Laquan McDonald case too. But yeah, Tina, what are your thoughts on Ed Burke?
Well, I think it's really sad, more than anything. And, you know, it was interesting that when he was being asked by reporters, when he was raided a couple times over the past month, we covered it here on Legal Face Off. He didn't seem all that concerned about it. Clearly, he didn't know that he was being tapped. So
not his first rodeo, as he said. He's been investigated before. He said that he intends to cooperate with the feds. By the way,
he's hired Jenner and Block, too, by the way.
Yeah. Can you not cooperate with the feds? I wasn't aware of that.
No, when the feds come.
Is there an option, Harry, that cooperate, not cooperate?
I think the only thing worse than your spouse saying we need to talk is the feds saying we need to talk.
Yeah, if a government agent ever brings over butcher paper to your office and starts to tape it to your wall, probably not a good look. So, Harry, what do we think? I mean, is this just business as usual in Chicago? It seems like we're inoculated to these things because of the amounts of corruption and governors in prison. But still, when you read the complaint, it's shocking to hear that he's on a wiretap saying, don't forget, we do property tax appeals, and can you give us the business?
Didn't he ever watch The Sopranos?
I mean,
I don't understand.
They're listening.
Right. You know, Blago getting taken down, you know, and I assume, without pretending to know how it works, I assume that by the time they've come to arrest you, that they have gobs and gobs of evidence that they didn't do it the first time they heard something. They just kept getting loading up evidence. So that when they get you in court, they're going to be able to say, hey, look what we've got on you. I don't understand how this guy wasn't more careful. And he's been around for forever.
He was 50 years.
Right. Yeah. He was a cop, right?
Right. And I mean, to your point, it's incredibly brazen. And he's actually the one making the calls. You would think an Ed Burke has people to take these calls. He's literally, if you read the complaint, the one taking the phone call and shaking these people down. I mean, it's unbelievable. Pedro, what are your thoughts on
this? This is one of these cases of politicians who have overstayed their welcome in Chicago politics. You know, this is a guy who's been in, he's been in the city council 50 years. Think about it. He's been chair of the finance committee for more than 30 years. All right, so this is a big fish. This is probably one of the biggest fish that the prosecutors have gone after, and I got to tell you, this is big news, and I don't think anybody saw this coming.
I think there's more to come, right? I think we haven't seen the end of the evidence. This is only the tip of it. Probably the happiest person in Chicago yesterday was another alderman, Ricardo Munoz, because he was in court for his own problems, but didn't get a lot of attention because of the Ed Burke shadow. Munoz is an alderman who announced he's not running for office again, and he was arrested on New Year's Eve for domestic battery. The allegation is that he pushed his wife down. She came out yesterday and said this has been an ongoing problem for years. There's been drinking and cheating. We often talk about how people dress when they show up in court. He showed up in a Blackhawks hoodie. Probably not the best way to impress a judge.
Unless it was autographed.
Well, maybe so.
You know,
yeah,
that sucker's autographed by Tony Esposito. the judge is a Hawks fan. That's cool. You know, the weird thing to me about this story is that she called the cops on New Year's Eve and he left. Well, how do you leave? Don't you want to present your side of the argument? Because he's got a background of alcoholism, and I can relate to that. There's, no way that he is going to look good having left the scene of the crime. I would think he would want to stay and show the cops, hey, guys, I'm coherent. I'm not drinking. I haven't hit her. Present his story. Because he left, it's become a he said, she said, and she's got bruises.
Yep. Yeah, Tina, this is a third alderman now. We've covered Munoz and Burke. There's a third alderman now who's under arrest or in the criminal process. Is this a problem in Chicago? What does this say about our politics and our elected officials?
Not much.
Not a great thing.
No,
right?
It's not a great thing at all between our aldermen and our governors. I'm not really sure where it leaves us. Hopefully 2019 is a better year in this regard. And once we get past the mayoral race, we'll be on the upswing. But yeah, we are not starting the year off on a good note when it comes to the aldermen of the city.
Pedro, you've been recognized as one of the 50 most influential Latinos in the Chicago area. Mr. Munoz is, of course, a very prominent Hispanic alderman. What's your take on that element of it?
He is the most senior, he's the most tenured Hispanic alderman in the city council. And he has had a storied history over the years. He's been involved in a number of controversies. And, you know, the interesting thing that I found about the order was that he was ordered to stay away from his wife, not only at her home, but at her workplace. But they work in the same building. They work in 2 Street, right? So, you know, he made this point to the judge, well, I answer on the city hall side. So it seems like he's relegated now only to the city hall side of the building because he can't cross over to the other side because his wife works there.
Well, and he was talked about as a mayoral candidate, you know, when he announced he wasn't running again for alderman. A lot of people had him pretty high up in the pecking order. Those dreams are gone, obviously. Let's move to another story involving a miniseries that I just finished watching yesterday, actually, Escape from Dannemora on Showtime. We're not sponsored by Showtime at all. But in the news this week was David Sweat, who is one of the two inmates depicted in Escape at Dannemora. He was the surviving escapee. He's the one who didn't get shot on the hill in Vermont. He's been moved 4 times. This past week, he was moved from Auburn Correctional Facility to Wen Correctional Facility in upstate New York. He had bragged to the prison officials at one of his last stays at Attica that he formulated an escape plan from that jail as well. And shockingly, 6 months later, they moved him to another jail. So first question is, has anyone seen Escape from Dannemora? I was transfixed.
I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, you saw the whole thing?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Did it inspire you to break out?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, pretty charming guy.
I learned how to cut through an HVAC system. I liked the show a lot. I thought it was a little bit slow when they were literally showing cutting for about 7 hours. You know, like, I think they could have condensed the cutting to like 10 minutes. We get it. He was cutting. You know, when they finally got to the escape, I thought it picked up. But, Harry, did you see any of this show?
No, my wife tells me I watch too much television, too. You know,
There's no such thing as too much television.
Thank you. I was probably watching another episode of Vikings, you know, and then there's no Vikings being indicted today. There's no Vikings being moved. But this is like, you know, a Stallone movie.
Yeah, these are two guys who just in 2015, recently, they escaped from this prison in Dannemora, which is near where I grew up. I grew up in Montreal, so right by the Canadian border is Dannemora. And they survived for, I think, 25 days or so before they got caught.
Yeah, with the help of the supervisor that worked there.
Yeah, that was the interesting part. The supervisor and a female civilian who worked at the prison, who was played by Patricia Arquette, who's now in jail also for, among other things, smuggling in tools through meat. Ground beef.
Not Patricia Arquette.
Patricia Arquette, yeah. not the actual Patricia. She depicted...
I was like, really?
No, she portrayed the character who would bring in tools that they used to cut through this metal in ground beef.
That's like in the old Westerns, guys used to bring cakes with files in it.
Exactly what happened in this case. Tina, you didn't see any of this yet?
I have not, but now I can't wait to go load it up and watch it.
All right, let's keep moving. There's a lawsuit involving an employee of the Seattle Mariners that's getting a lot of attention, especially in the light of all the Me Too news that we've heard. Tell us about that, Tina.
Lorena Martin was the former director of high performance for the Mariners. And a couple of weeks ago, she filed suit against the team alleging discriminatory treatment due to her being both a woman and a Latina. She claims that she repeatedly informed multiple staff members and senior management at the Mariners about these issues, but that nothing was done to address them. I mean, very high level, there were a lot of allegations in this lawsuit and in the events leading up to it. She was hired in November of 2017, and she was responsible for physical and mental training for the team, as well as overseeing their overall health and strength and conditioning. She claims that right after she was hired, there were a number of incidents that happened right away, demonstrating discriminatory treatment, including derogatory comments being made by management about her specific, as well as about Latino catchers and managers. There are also claims that members of management blamed Latino players for ruining the team's clubhouse culture, and that her away game travel, which was an important part of her job, was reduced significantly because management didn't want the players to get dependent on her. She also claims that there were a number of communications with her with the intent to intimidate her. And that actually when it came to Felix Hernandez, one of the players, that they were trying to intentionally undermine him. So Major League Baseball said a couple of months ago that they were investigating her claims. And the Mariners said that they have done their own internal review and determined that her claims are unfounded.
Harry laughs at that.
Harry laughs.
What a shocking response, right?
Right. Hey, you know what? Turns out we didn't do anything wrong. Okay. So,
said every guy everywhere.
Right. There's so many levels to this. First of all, to her point, Nelson Cruz, the best power hitter on the Mariners, is now a Minnesota Twin. And Robbie Cano, who was the other guy you could have called their best power hitter, their best all-around player, is now a New York Met. So these two guys are no longer with the team. Felix Hernandez has been one of the best pitchers in baseball for the last 10 years, easy. King Felix in Seattle. He is the face of the Mariners. And when they say that they didn't want the players to become too dependent on her, I mean, isn't this why she's hired?
Exactly.
Is to bring out the best and to be there as a sounding board, to be there as someone they could talk to.
She's the director of high performance. You'd think that they would want them to highly perform.
Right. The show with Paul Giamatti right now, where he's the New York State's attorney.
Billions
is great. They've got a therapist as one of their key players in the organization.
Paid $25 million a year.
Because they understand the value of how important that. 25 years ago, it was a big taboo. The idea, a sports psychologist. And John Smoltz, the great Brave pitcher, who's now an analyst, was like the first guy to come out and say, hey, it helps me to talk to someone. She wanted to go on an East Coast trip. Hernandez wanted her to go on the East Coast trip, 10 days, Baltimore, Boston, New York, and they wouldn't let her go.
Yeah, and Harry, listen, you host White Sox Weekly here on WGN. You know baseball inside and out for the last many, many years. One of the allegations also in this complaint is that the Mariners were systematically undervaluing Hispanic players, and they were accusing them. I mean, one of the allegations is that Jerry DePoto, who's the GM, said in a serious and condescending manner that Latino players don't work hard, they're lazy, and it's part of their culture. You just referenced several of the Hispanic players. Also, Scott Servais, the manager, allegedly...
Former Cub,
said that especially Dominican players, they aren't bright enough. That's why you don't see any Latino managers or Latino catchers. You've been around baseball forever. Is this true? Do people still have these antiquated feelings against minority players?
If there's an individual Latino player that is lazy, it's so unfair to group them all together. It's ridiculous. In football right now, we just had Black Monday, the first Monday after the NFL season ends. Now there's been a total of 8 coaches fired. 5 of them happen to be African-American. There's the Rooney Rule in place where you have to, when you're interviewing for a new coach, you have to interview a minority. Right now, there's 32 teams. 3 of them have minorities. 2 are, as head coaches. The Chargers and the Steelers have African-American head coaches. The Panthers have former Bear Ron Rivera as a head coach. That's it. The largest percentage of people in the NFL are African-Americans, yet there's only 2, African-American coaches. But Lovie Smith didn't get fired because of his color. Lovie Smith got fired because he lost the locker room. Lovie Smith was fired because he couldn't do anything, and he's having trouble at the U of I.
About to be fired there, too. Pedro, is baseball one of the last vestiges of racism, of sexual harassment, is it one of the places where the Old Boys Network still survives?
Well, it seems the Old Boys Network is there, but what I found intriguing about this is, and I know this is litigation, but the Mariners originally wanted to get this case settled in arbitration. They put together this response in arbitration, and they said they fired her because she created a hostile work environment. Right, so it's now all of this is public, right? Because they've revealed this when they've moved this case to the courts. But just that response alone, right? There's a woman who is alleging all of these things against the Mariners, and in this environment, this Me Too environment, to just say, "Well, we fired her because she created a hostile work environment for us," it just seems it's tone deaf.
Yeah,
no question. All right, moving on to another story that has interested us for many, months here on Legal Faceoff. Kevin Spacey back in the news for all the wrong reasons, Tina.
Of course, unfortunately.
Not because of TV. Although somewhat because of TV. Did you see that video?
I did not see.
Did you guys see the video over the holidays?
Yes. It was bizarre.
Where he's Kevin Spacey video where he's playing his
Underwood,
role.
Yeah, right.
Underwood. It was really strange.
I'm going to say his lawyers did not see it.
Not a good move, especially in light of what Tina's about to tell us.
He is going to be arraigned on Monday in connection with a felony sexual assault charge in Nantucket over an alleged 2016 incident at a Nantucket bar. On December 24th, right before Christmas, he was charged with felony indecent assault and battery for allegedly groping a then 18-year-old man in July of 2016. The charges came about when the alleged victim's girlfriend told police that her boyfriend texted her to say that Spacey was hitting on him. He then sent her a Snapchat video showing Spacey improperly touching the front of his pants. Spacey made headlines earlier this week in connection with this case when he formally requested and was denied the ability to waive his court appearance requirement on the basis that he resides out of state. And he also claimed that his presence in court would amplify the negative publicity that has already been generated in connection with the case. I don't know about you guys, but I think he's already got a lot of negative publicity. I don't think showing up in court is necessarily going to move the needle on
Harry, what the hell is wrong with Kevin Spacey?
Well, I mean, I loved him in Usual Suspects, but I don't love him in real life. He doesn't want to go to court because his celebrity will interfere with the court and the jurors' ability to judge him fairly. Yet he used that celebrity to put these young men, these kids, in a horrible position, time after time after time. Again, this is not one isolated incident.
Yeah, and that video, Pedro, did you see that video over
there? He's I don't know if you haven't seen it. He's wearing the Santa apron, and he's occasionally sipping from a mug. And he seems to inhabit this House of Cards character. And
he's
saying,
playing Underwood.
He's playing Underwood, exactly right. And then he says, you never actually saw me die, did you? And it's just, the whole thing is bizarre, and nobody knows what it means.
Really, really strange.
And the show was so, House of Cards was so good.
Unwatchable this season, I found. Not because he was gone. I just thought it was incredibly slow. And
How does he come back when he's been killed off as a character? I don't know how that works.
I don't know, but it has been done in television before, Pedro.
Right. Absolutely.
A dream.
All right, finishing off our grab bag segment, Tina, there's a couple of copyright intellectual property stories that are, of course, near and dear to your heart. Bring us up to speed.
Well, yeah, so I feel like after the stories we've talked about that this is going to be a letdown, but for those IP lawyers out there, this is an IP story of international intrigue, the one about the copyrighted bikini. So this
did you
got
say
some...
copyrighted bikini?
I did.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
I was wondering when we would come to those words on the show, but it's been five years, finally.
Yeah, I was going to say it only took 5 years, right? And it took having me join the show. So this got some headlines because the New York Times had a recent article about this, and it's a long, complicated set of facts. But the gist of it is you've got a Turkish entrepreneur named İpek Ergit who goes to Brazil and sees a really cool crocheted bikini by a Brazilian street artist named Maria Solange Ferrarini back in 2012. She then decides, she being Ergit, decides that she's going to come back to the States and that she's going to start having these manufactured in China, and she's going to start selling them in the States under the brand Kini. Well, apparently sales of the Kini really took off, and there were a number of copycats of the Kini. Let's remember, Kini is a copycat of somebody else's bikini in Brazil. So Ergit, who decided to copy the Kini from this Brazilian woman, decides to get pretty empowered here, and she starts suing these copycats, including Victoria's Secret, back in 2015. That suit ultimately settled in 2017, but then she decided to sue Neiman Marcus and a number of swimwear companies, including one that is owned by a woman whose husband is a law firm partner. This law firm partner decides to do some digging, and he discovers that this bikini is a copy of the one that this woman saw back in Brazil. He also finds out that the old business colleague of this woman who copied the bikini design had a major falling out with her and admitted to her that she had copied the design. So as Jerry Seinfeld likes to say, yada, yada, Kini decided to withdraw her lawsuit against Neiman Marcus. She's been sued by the Brazilian woman and by the lawyer whose wife owns this particular swimwear manufacturer. And A motion to dismiss has been filed, as well as a motion to disqualify. So nothing's been completely resolved yet. But I think the moral of the story is, as I tell my clients when they want to go around suing people for infringing their IP, it's always good to make sure you own it first before you start suing people.
That's right.
I'm not looking at you, Pedro.
Pedro.
Yes. I personally am not a Keeney consumer. But, you know, the interesting legal point here is potentially you have a woman who appears to have taken the intellectual property of somebody else, registered it as her own, and now she's suing an entire industry over something that she didn't create and potentially actually stole from somebody else.
Right? Just, I know, it's mind-boggling. It's
there's a word for that, Harry,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it takes sports, we would say it takes balls.
Yeah,
yeah, very, the lawyers say audacious.
Very, very bold. Yeah, right. Tina, what about some other intellectual property news? There are some works that have been long protected that are now in the public domain, yes?
Yes. So this is really, the fun time for copyright lawyers right now between bikinis and issues regarding public domain. So this past Tuesday on January 1st, there were an unprecedented number of films, books, songs, and other artistic works that were created back in 1923 that fell into the public domain because their copyright expired. Some of you may remember that copyright lasts generally for 75 years or 50 years after the author passes away. And the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which came into effect about 20 years ago, extended the term of those copyrights by 20 years. So the impact is that a number of pretty famous works have now fallen into the public domain. So
things like the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
Harry's favorite Passover movie.
Anytime you get Charlton Heston, you know, in a robe, how can you go wrong?
Edward G. Robinson.
Right.
Miscast as a... There's a famous Billy Crystal, Edward G. Robinson, bring me your Hebrides. Yeah, see? And of course, yes, we have No Bananas is now...
Yes, which is just something that we all sing all the time, is now in the public domain.
And then The Prophet, so you could see
and
maybe...
And The Prophet, and then film. Robert Frost.
Yeah, Robert Frost.
Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening.
Yeah, Harry, have you been waiting for the 75 years now to expire so you could finally get in on these copyrighted works?
Yes, I'm so there.
Or are you more... more baffled by the Sonny Bono part of it.
Really, I'm sitting there. Well, first of all,
I'm
doing the math. So I've got one more year, and then I can claim I wrote It's a
yes,
Wonderful Life.
Absolutely, you can get in on.
Okay, Pedro, I see you as the angel. So Sonny Bono, upon his death, they went to court, and they said you get an extra 20 years of earning the rights because, I mean, he wrote "I Got You, Babe," and all, you know. And
oh
all
yeah, so "I Got You, Babe." It's like, you know, that one we've got to protect as long as possible.
Sonny
a lot
Bono
of it was driven by Disney.
Sonny Bono is a well-known legal trailblazer.
Is he at the Alyssa Milano level?
Yes, exactly. Pedro, what are your thoughts? Have you been anxiously awaiting
FedEx can now put miles to go on all of its trucks. And I think Easy Win and Down Flake would be a great line of like laundry soap or something like that. But not somebody who won, you know, four Pulitzers and whose name sits on a Vermont mountain needs anything more to cement his reputation. But, yeah, you know, coming to a coffee mug near you.
But Steamboat Willie is still protected till 2024.
Yes.
The Mickey Mouse cartoon that started it all. Well, Harry, any parting thoughts before we sign off on Legal Face-Off on any of these topics or just the legal world in general? The microphone is yours, sir.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so many, you know, I mean, can the Bulls, can we sue the Bulls for the Jim Boylan move, the new coach?
Boylan going to survive the season, you think? He seems to have gone over that hump of, you know, rage that he started with and looks like he's going to maybe... survive the season?
Well, their star rookie, Wendell Carter Jr. from Duke, he didn't play him the other night, really. He played him 13 and a half minutes, and they asked him after the game, why didn't you play him more? And he said, well, as a rookie, you can learn as much by sitting and watching as you can by playing. So if that's the case, I'm a great basketball player.
we're all in that boat.
Right. You know, I'm a great chef. I'm a great stripper. You know.
What about where do the White Sox stand? It's been quiet for 2 weeks on the Harper Machado stakes.
Right.
Are the White Sox still in the running?
Yeah. They are in the run. They're very much in the running. I think that they're very much in the running for Machado now. And Machado really, Harper's the sexier pick, but Machado is the the one that fits the puzzle better. He's a third baseman. The Sox need a third baseman. They've got Eloy Jimenez, you know, coming up. He's going to be a corner outfielder for 10 years. They've got, you know, a terrific young outfield coming up. They could use a third baseman. And Harper's agent, Scott Boras, he always wants the most money, the most years. And I think the Phillies are going to give Harper more money, and the Dodgers might give him more money. They just did this trade to give away half their guys. But I think the Sox could be now, you know, looking at Machado at third base, which is great. And they just got his brother-in-law, Yonder Alonso, from Cleveland, who plays first.
Where's Abreu going to play?
He'll split. He'll split the time, you know, until they move him.
Do you want to play with your brother-in-law? That's the question. Would you want to play with your brother-in-law, Tina, if you were a White Sox? Do you have a brother-in-law?
I have a bunch of sisters-in-laws because I've got all brothers. So, but I'd through like my husband, I've got brother-in-law. Yeah, I mean, why not? If I like them, right? Yeah. I mean, if I like them, but if I don't like them, then I don't want to play with them.
Yeah, well, if the White Sox do sign one of these guys, I mean, maybe their attendance will move from, what, dead last to second to last? Do you think it'll drive a lot of season ticket sales? Or?
I think that it's coming. When Sox fans criticize Cubs fans, you guys show up no matter what. You're idiots. Cubs fans criticize Sox fans. You guys don't show up unless your team is great. But they've got a plan, and Reinsdorf is not getting any younger. You got to kind of give kudos to Reinsdorf for letting this plan unfold over a few years. But they have the money to actually get Harper and Machado this year. They're going to be loaded in a very short time. The Sox will be very, very loaded.
Pedro, final thought on the Bears on Sunday. How big? We know they're going to win. We know they're going to destroy the Eagles. The question, of course, is
right.
Are we still going to even care after halftime? We'll be
Bears,
such a blowout.
Bears fan always care.
Bears fan.
They always care.
Harry, predictions for Sunday?
Yeah.
Bears
62, Philadelphia 3.
You heard it there first. Tino Artini, thanks for all your hard work this week. Behind the glass, Ben Anderson, our trusty producer. Of course, Sam. It's going to be a weekly thing. Where's Sam, right?
Yeah, is
the
he
allegation
coming?
Of Sam Panjanovich.
He's gambling in Las Vegas.
We thank our guests on the phone and the special guest in studio, Harry Tynowitz, checking in on White Sox Weekly here on WGN. And, of course, Pedro de Jesus. Thank you for joining us in studio on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this. Now, courtroom combat.